This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. And the morning run begins its ascent into the stratosphere. We're taking it all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. It's the 24th of July. And, of course, it's just a Tuesday. So we're not even midway through the week, but I'm so excited because it's going to be an exciting week, I think, ahead of us. So, yes, are you excited about
very
the week?
Very much.
Oh, there you go, Joyce, vote of confidence. And there I'm looking at Han, you know, and the Malay expression, tersengeh macam kerang busuk, comes to mind when I look at him this morning.
Is it Friday yet?
No, not yet. Not yet Friday. Okay, actually, there's some sad news in the media. We have a shooting out in Toronto, Canada. Gunman has killed a woman and a child and injured, I think, about a dozen other people. And because it reminds you again of, you know, terror attacks. Tomorrow also we have the Pakistani elections. It's said to be the dirtiest elections in years. Because this follows some quite astounding terror attacks there as well. In Balochistan, about a week and a half ago, about 130 people died as a result of a suicide bombing. 130. Often doesn't rate as high in the news agenda as, say, a killing in Canada, in Toronto, in peaceful Toronto. Balochistan, of course, being, I think, riven by violence, you know, political violence all these years. So it's kind of the norm is slightly different, I guess.
Right, you know, because, you know, how much can we relate to Balochistan as opposed to something that happens in Canada, right?
No,
because
I don't know. I mean, you know, Balochistan full of people, human beings. Yeah. Canada apparently also just has human beings.
Well, again, it's the familiarity that you have with not just certain geographical locations, but certain cultures as well. And I dare say that more people have heard about Toronto than Balochistan, right? And so, I mean, that's the nature of news. I mean, so often we hear about these mass killings or these civil wars that happen in troubled regions and people don't bat an eyelid. But then you got 13 boys stuck in a cave in Thailand and the whole world is gripped by it, right? So, I mean, that's just the nature of news, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, I think it's also, I don't think it's a done deal with the news. I think it's the way the news wants to make something either more familiar or less familiar, right? So they media could make an effort to humanize people from said unknown parts of the world.
Balochistan, yeah.
Yeah, like Balochistan. Okay, anyway, that's not all that's in the media. There's quite a number of, I think, stories that are animating conversations around, including the ongoing developments in the Trump administration, those around the Trump administration. Trump, I think a story around Trump leads the conversation on the BBC World Service website. Trump targets critics' security clearance. Just part of the ongoing battle out in Washington, D.C.
Right. The revolving door, that infamous revolving door with the Trump administration. Well, this time around, it's in relation to security clearances for several ex-Obama officials. That appears to be in his crosshairs. There, you know, like, but at the same time, you know, given the heightened frequency of such tirades and attacks, you know, you kind of think that markets have kind of grown callous to it somewhat.
Oh, yeah, I think they're maybe
used
to it.
Calluses.
Well, they're used, they're just used to Trump and things that are coming out from his tweets or his mouth. Right?
I mean, it certainly raises the spectrum of political risk, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he's you know, his position in Russia changing, it seems, every other day. Mm. Okay, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Argent with Hold Your Head Up. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. And the morning run continues. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. We're always eager to hear what you have to say about the issues of the day. And we're going to start off with something we're all, almost all of us, are familiar with. It is the Open Planned Office. And it's always said, it's de rigueur now. Most offices, you know, most companies have designed their workspace in such a way. But is it really that good?
Yeah, well, I mean, according to this new study, it found that employees in open plan offices spend 73% less time in face-to-face interactions. So, you know, you end up emailing and messaging each other. That's email and messaging use shot up by over 67%. So this whole theory that in an open plan office, you tend to talk more, you tend to interact more, that may be false.
Right. Well, I guess it very much depends on the culture and the nature of the job, eh? I mean, I would think that with media organizations, because of the tremendous amount of collaboration required between the editors, the reporters, you know, presenters, producers, etc., right, you need to, you know, make sure those lines of communication are open. As opposed to, oh, for example, I worked in KPMG in Sydney for about a year. Even though it was open plan, everyone was just very quietly tapping away, sending emails. I had a colleague who had a full-blown argument via email with somebody seated on the other end of the floor, right? Yeah. Even though it's an open floor plan, yeah. Oh. So it very much depends on the culture and the nature of the job.
You know, what's interesting is the gap between the theory and the practice. So in theory, if you think about an open plan office, it seems much more democratic, it seems more transparent, it's designed to allow greater access, even visual access mm-hmm. to your colleagues. So nobody can kind of hide away or, you know, and pretend to work. Everybody's kind of, as it were, in full view. But the reality seems quite different because people always remake spaces for themselves, right? So they'll take something that's designed for one purpose and perhaps repurpose it for their own ends. And so, you know, that's where, as you say, Han, you know, culture kicks in and the nature of the job kicks in. And so all the best laid plans of interior designers and architects, you know, will go to waste.
Yeah, and this research also found that, you know, employees who can't concentrate, they tend to communicate less. So they become indifferent to their colleagues. In a way, if you need your own privacy, then you tend to, like, clamp up more. And also it states that, you know, many employers, they're heavily focused on driving collaboration and interaction. But this comes at the expense of privacy and concentration. So people tend to lose their concentration sometimes, you know, if it gets too, in an open plan office. It depends as well.
What kind of strategies have you elected for to kind of maintain some amount of privacy, manage, you know, to actually get some work done? I see in our own office, you know, some individuals have little signs that say, you know, it's either red or green, and red suggests that you don't disturb them at a point in time. Green suggests that you can, in fact, interact with them.
Well, we have a former colleague. No name's going to be mentioned here, but he used to have white noise just playing on his earphones the whole time, remember? So, like, he would just have his earphones on the whole time, and it just white noise. It just
yeah, that
like,
was Julian's strategy.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yeah,
so we're going to throw him under the bus. He's not even here to defend himself.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing to, I mean, to be embarrassed. I mean, yeah. I think it's a legitimate strategy in an open plan office to find ways to protect your space. And as you say, Joyce, you know, the study notes that you have to kind of give up not just privacy, but also your ability to focus.
Yeah.
I mean, that is major for an organization and for productivity.
Well, then using Julian's experience then, I mean, because I sat like, what, you know, 5 feet in front of his face. And there were times when even...
You can see why he was looking away.
Thanks, buddy. Look, there were many times when I struggled to get his attention, even though he was just 5 feet away from, and we were facing each other, right? So that came at a cost, the cost being a lack of communication or the lack of an instant response, right? So it's a push and pull. It's never
okay, so should we go back to the old office, the office of rooms and doors and,
no.
You know, and opaque glass? What do you think?
Maybe a mix. Depends. Again, I agree with you, Han. Depends on the culture and the industry they're in. I think for media in a newsroom environment, you need open plan, but you should have some rooms as well for private chats because it's very difficult to have that kind of... Or sometimes when you're calling a contact to chase a story, you kind of need that space.
Yeah. I say generally open plan offices because so much of our communication is non-verbal. You want to see those facial expressions, those body language, as opposed to just text on a screen via email.
Well, I'm not quite sure. I like the dark, you know,
you like
wooden,
room,
heavy doors,
okay.
And guards, preferably. Okay, tell us what you think. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. And the morning run continues. It's 21 minutes after 6 in the morning. And as you know, we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock with a range of interviews, news and analysis. And you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Okay, now something that's that sometimes comes back to haunt you is a off-color joke, right? So you tell a joke and some people laugh and some people don't laugh and it's fine, you know, you'd probably be forgiven if you're telling it to friends. But what if you put it on social media and it survives the moment, as it were, for eternity? That joke just continues on and somebody calls you up for it.
Yeah, so in this case, I think we're talking about James Gunn. He was fired from Guardians 3 after old tweets joking about insensitive topics came up. And now there's a whole debate whether or not he should have tweeted what he did.
Insensitive topics. You're referring to his off-color jokes about rape and pedophilia, right?
Right.
And James Gunn is the director involved in Guardians.
Right. I mean, because this is a tricky one, right? On one hand, these individuals are elevated to a role model status because of, you know, their reach and their influence via their Hollywood projects. You know, we saw that with various individuals linked to the Me Too movement, right? There is that backlash there, but at the same time, you know, like, where do you draw the line between a joke and something that's done, you know, seriously? And
well, a joke is by definition not serious.
Yeah, but
It obviously is a reflection of also your mindset. And
it's context dependent, right?
Yeah, and it's transgressive. I mean, that's the whole point about humor.
Irreverent.
Sometimes. And so, you know, I think what's happened is that we've really swung the other way in terms of so-called sensitive issues. Instead of the state censoring us, we have, you know, other people censoring us, and they use these issues, including jokes, some of them which can be quite vile, you know. But for me, you know, that is no reason for somebody to lose their jobs. And this is what exactly has happened. I mean, James Gunn has lost his job, his livelihood, because some people don't like jokes that he told, what, was it 9 years ago?
Yeah, okay. But if you look at the jokes, I mean, for me, I feel if you go through, I'm not going to repeat them on air, but to me, I find it insensitive. I don't think it was appropriate for him to joke. Disney is saying that it's because it's indefensible and inconsistent with their studio's values. Also, because, I mean, he joked about, you know.
Yeah, in other words, like, how do you find a justification after someone has, or you have evidence of someone joking about rape and pedophilia, right? Mm. I mean, try doing the mental gymnastics there and trying to justify such a joke, right? 9 years ago, 9 years ago, 90...
It doesn't matter when.
Right, you know, so...
Yeah. Because a joke signifies what? That he's in fact, indulging in it?
It's not whether... he shouldn't even be joking about it. It's not a topic to be joking about.
Well, I mean, I think that's the nature of humor, right? In fact, the thing about
to
humor
joke
is
about rape?
Everything is... could be
about
used...
pedophilia? That's something to
Absolutely.
Joke about?
No, it's not. I mean, you might not agree, but the point about humor is that it's always been, throughout the history of man,
I don't see anything humorous in those topics at all.
Well, you might not. So the question is, if somebody indulges in it and you don't like his humor, should he or she lose his job? I mean, that, I think, is the question before us.
Yeah.
It's not whether he should have told that joke. He clearly did. If you don't like it, you don't laugh about it, that's fine. But should he lose his job?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it's reputational risk as well, right? Because of the responses or the backlash against not just Mr. Gunn, but also, I mean, well, as Joyce has evidenced there, it's, you know, it's very hard.
Disney says it's inconsistent with their studio's values.
And it's hard to justify such a thing. You know, does Disney want to take on that kind of risk, you know, as an entity? And well, should he have lost his job? Well, I guess that's something for Disney to decide, and they have decided that it is not worth it.
Well, tell us what you think. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018- 7898899. I think in the few seconds that we have left, one might ask, you know, what is the consequence of living in a society where your every action is being policed, and your every action, including things you did, well, as a young adult, maybe you're a teenager. I mean, I don't know how far you can go back when you start working with this kind of logic, the logic that in fact leads to, I think, very fascistic consequences.
Delete that Twitter account, buddy.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have nothing to apologize about. The Cardigans and Carnival taking us up to the first bulletin of the morning. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the specials with Rat Race. I'm Shoaib Khuttin, with me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. We're not in a rat race, but we are moving ahead, taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. Now, a conversation that's all the rage down in Singapore, the question of what Grab has done with those rewards that it gives to its loyal customers. And every time you take a service with Grab, you get some sort of points. Now, those points constitute a rebate of a substantial level. I mean, it's about 5%, and you can reclaim them in different ways. Now, is it right or is it the prerogative of a company to change the value of those rewards that they so generously give to you?
Well, I think so. I mean, you've got, say, credit card companies who do the same as well. No, with some of my credit cards, when I first sign up, you get double amount of points for this particular dining place and yada, yada, yada. And a few months later, it's changed.
Yeah, right? That's so right.
It happens.
Yeah, and after that, they'll tell you, it's a renewal for, you can renew your credit card for free after every year. And after that, they're like, they have to knock off some points to get it free for a renewal. Yeah, it depends on the company. Looking at... in this case, I think Grab's case, what you're talking about, Sharad, is an article that came up saying that some earning rates have been devalued by some 90%, depending on your reward system with them, right?
Yeah, Which level of reward? I must say, I think it's really unfair. Somebody who actually takes this service on a regular basis and for whom, those rebates do mean something. They're not just that incidental, happy if I have it, happy if I don't have it. It is part of the choices I make about what service I take, right? So in the Klangvet, at least, I have two options when it comes to e-hailing services. So there's Grab, but there's also MyCar. Mm-hmm. And then so MyCar, then sometimes I think, if the price differential is not so great, then I'll go with the company where I've already got, all accumulated rewards, right? And so it's part of my calculation. Now, if you give it to me at one particular value, and then you, 2 months down the line, you say, well, it's not as much as it was initially, then I feel cheated. I think I have a legitimate reason to feel cheated.
Well, now, whether or not you're the exception or if there's enough clout or you can gather the masses behind this movement of yours and bring it to Grab.
I'm sure. No hashtag yet. Not yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure if you present this to Grab and you can include this into your future calculations as well, right? Do you want to risk your discounts and rebates being devalued in the future, or you just go with the competitor? I think, Sharad, you just got to wean yourself all those discounts, man. You got to get yourself all the discounts.
Okay, so I'm not a coupon cutter. I'm not a coupon cutter, though I know people who take those things very seriously, right? Mm. And this is something the companies put up. They entice or hope to build brand loyalty using these devices. Now, do they undercut themselves when they do something like this? Do they undercut that loyalty?
No, I guess it's a way. Reward system is very big right now. I think for people, as competition gets more intense, it's a way to retain customers. Coming back to the Grab rewards, guys, I think there's an update. They've restored the previous reward system.
Yeah, great, so yeah. After getting hammered left, right, and center by customers
like me
for devaluing Grab rewards, making the requirements much more difficult to accumulate points, Grab has made a U-turn. So it looks like they are responding to you, Sheraton.
I think this rewards thing is only in Singapore, if we're not mistaken, right? I think.
Yeah. I didn't even have to do the hashtag.
Yeah.
He's that powerful. He's that influential.
Well, this is an article.
The U-turn even before you started on your tirade. Wow.
Before it even came to Malaysia.
This is from a website. We're going to tweet out a link to this. It's milelion.com. And so, I think companies are very sensitive to public opinion, reasonable or unreasonable, But in this case, I think there's a contradiction in giving somebody a reward and then sort of undercutting it. It doesn't make sense to do it that way.
Right. I mean, yeah, reputational risk and all that good stuff, right? But I've got bigger problems with, say, how their Grab wallet is being rolled out here in Malaysia.
GrabPay?
GrabPay, right? Because there are a couple of guys, a couple of stores here, they have the GrabPay. So I'm like, I'm going to go check it out. They don't even know how to operate the damn thing. Oh, sorry. They don't even know how to operate the GrabPay. So I asked, what can I use my GrabPay? Like, we just put a sticker on there. We don't know how it works.
What?
What was the whole point? Yeah, gosh. They got to spend a lot more in terms of training.
Educating.
Yeah, the retail outlets.
Yeah.
Okay. We can be part of this conversation. Remember, you can tweet us or WhatsApp us. Thank you for all the WhatsApps and tweets that have come in. A lot of them about the question of jokes and what we have. Everybody from Navita Sri Shankar says, one shouldn't be making such jokes. To Thiagaraja says that... the responses to it could be excessive.
Yeah, I mean, because on one hand, you risk normalizing such jokes, right? That's on one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, where do we take into account the evolution of the person? Will we be the same person 9 years ago? Should we be made to feel the repercussions for something we did almost a decade ago?
Also, thank you, Phillips Santa Maria, for your don't tell jokes about rape or pedophilia, never. Okay, we'll be back. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. And that was Ray Charles with Sticks and Stones. The question, of course, is the names that people give us. We have a foreign minister who's been dubbed the basketball minister. And that's because... not because of his dimensions, but because of his love of the game. And apparently he was known as a basketball aficionado long before he became foreign minister.
Yeah, so he's saying that, sports has its own role in forging unity, in nurturing certain positive traits in people. And he thinks that sports has a role to play in diplomacy.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the likes of Dennis Rodman and him being able to have those ties with North Korea because of his status as a NBA star or former NBA star. Also, if you look at how sports pulled South Korea and also North Korea together, right? Sports is definitely, without a doubt, a powerful tool when it comes to, fostering ties between countries.
Yeah, but also can foster rivalries.
Sure.
So sometimes, games between nations become like a proxy war, right? So that's one possible scenario when it comes to sports. But the other side, of course, is that when everybody's, as a word, and I'm going to use this somewhat gendered term, gentlemanly in sports, it can foster goodwill. And, if you remember, not only was it the basketball game between North and South Korea, but it was also the cheerleaders. The cheerleaders from North Korea also came in and gave a much softer edge to a country that has been often vilified and demonized as being some sort of weird, throwback from some some totalitarian past in the 20th century.
Right, but one has to ask, though, whether this kind of diplomacy is just superficial. Does it actually go... is it substantial enough to actually change policies or, change you know, foreign relations, right, at a substantial level?
Or good
is it just,
question.
Okay, yeah, no, we'll just go have a game of basketball. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then whether or not, I mean, from there, the governments can take it further. I guess from the sporting event, and then whether or not they want to push that further. Yeah, how are they going to do it, though? Yeah,
that's... Well, you see, okay, so I, so foreign policy might be something that only policy wonks and, you know, high state officials get involved in. But there's also public opinion, especially in, I think, democratic countries, that needs to be addressed. And so if you have, for instance, demonized the country as being a rival enemy state and, you know, threat to your existent, you know, an existential threat to your nation and so on and so forth, then, and you want to change tact, how do you do it, right? I mean, so you have to persuade the public that your pivot on those relationships are based on a new understanding of that other country. So I think you, these efforts could be seen as softening the ground for a change in policy orientation by the government. I mean, because in non-democratic societies and authoritarian states, it doesn't really matter what your public thinks. You just make a decision that, you know, this is an enemy state or now a friendly state, depending on, you know, whatever contingencies there are.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of seeing it a different way, though, whereby sports appears to be an extension of existing you know, policies or biases within the current administration. So, for example, if your country does not have ties with, say, the state of Israel, then you'll be barring their athletes from coming in, don't have those friendlies with them, right? Don't recognize them at international sporting events. You know, the list goes on and on, right? So if there's that will to begin with, then sports facilitates it. If that will isn't even there, then, you know, there's really not much that sports can do.
Yeah, that's true. Well, according to the our new foreign minister, he's saying that, you know, some people used to say education is a platform for diplomacy, but he's saying sports is important, but we have to do it well, because sometimes, you know, sporting competitions can also cause a backlash. So they have to do that whole event well as well. Because you might end up, instead of forging, I mean, good ties with the other country, you might end up fighting with each other because of that event.
Yeah, there's also this thing, right? The one-off sporting events as opposed to long-term soft power strategies. So South Korea, you know, is in the hearts of so many, and I say, you know, advisedly, young people in this country, because I know there are older people also, because of the K-wave, because of those boy bands and those girl bands, and because of, you know, the TV series, the dramas,
and
all that, right? The television series, you know, I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying, yes, we must go to war with South Korea. I mean, whatever the, if that was the case, right? Because there's so much love and they have so much cultural and political capital because of their outreach through popular culture. And I think that is something quite extraordinary to mine as well. Okay, we're coming up to the top of the hour. Next, our second bulletin in the morning, and taking us there, The Strange Blue Dreams with Reverberating Love. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.